It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Construction, as you know, is a constant hum here in the city. But if you think you've noticed even more scaffolding than usual lately, you are not wrong. WNYC is covering the current real estate boom with a series called Who's Buying New York? And here with me now to talk about how this real estate boom is beginning to change the city are WNYC's Ilya Meritz and Janet Babin, who are on this beat. Hi, Ilya. Hi, Janet.
Good Hello. Morning.
Are we definitely, Janet, in the midst of a boom? Are there numbers to back that up?
Absolutely. Just about every number out in 2014 showed that this was the best year ever for sales in New York City. And Ilya talked to some brokers who can back that up personally.
Yeah, well, so last week we actually learned the average sales price of a Manhattan apartment hit a new record. It eclipsed the 2008 peak. It was $1.7 million.
And you mentioned 2008, and let me just jump in there and say, I guess we are back, because when the financial crisis hit, it was at the end of a long period of real estate boom in New York and obviously incredible inflation in real estate prices in New York. And then things became so tough when the bubble burst that, you know, condos that were very desirable that were under construction in Williamsburg and all around the city were abandoned before anybody occupied them. You had Hakeem Jeffries and other politicians saying, oh, we have all these unoccupied condos that were built and now can't be sold. We should turn them into affordable housing. There was such a crash. But you're saying now we're back to pre-financial crisis levels.
It was so striking at that time because we kind of thought, well, maybe we overbuilt, right? Like maybe this is right. We have these like
it
sort
was
of,
such a
sort
hallmark
of zombie towers.
Of the Bloomberg era.
Exactly.
Build.
And that's really why Janet and I and our colleague Jessica Gould wanted to do this series is there's just so much happening now. They're popping up like mushrooms. For a little context, the total sales volume of building sales in New York City, 2009, $6.2 billion. This year, we'll find out in a week or so, but this year the forecast is $63 billion, so 10 times as much. It's just so striking.
Listeners, have you noticed this real estate boom in, can I call it concrete terms? Have you tried to buy an apartment and were you outbid by an all-cash buyer who maybe isn't even from New York? Remember, the series is called Who's Buying New York? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Do you find yourself recently writing a rent check to a landlord who doesn't live here in New York, maybe not even in the United States, which is apparently another characteristic of this particular boom? Give us a call and give us your personal economic indicators regarding the real estate boom in New York right now. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Ilya, in your piece today, you profiled a broker?
That's right. Yeah. Adelaide Polsinelli is a investment sales broker at Eastern Consolidated. She handles sales for all kinds of buildings. So not individual apartments, but it could be an apartment building or a mixed-use building, could be a commercial property. And I kind of took two lessons from following her for a day. One was that with prices rising as fast as they are, you kind of have to look other places. Like an area that she's concentrating her efforts is the Bronx, believe it or not, Third Avenue in the Bronx. And there's a lot of activity already happening there.
Luxury buildings? Market rate?
I'm not sure about luxury, but there are two new hotels there.
Uh-huh.
And there's a Planet Fitness and a bunch of national chains that probably you wouldn't have seen there a few years ago. They are moving in. She calls it the new 14th Street, the new 34th Street in terms of sort of a,
shopping
I don't know, like
district.
A shopping district, lower rent, mid-rent kind of shopping district. The other thing that I took away from following Adelaide Polsinelli was really that price per square foot matters a great deal. And so if you're going to buy in a central part of Manhattan, if you're going to buy a building here and pay top dollar, it may not pay to keep the building as a rental building. You may need to demolish the building that you buy and put up a 40-story tower instead of a 4-story building. That's exactly actually what she had described to me when we spent that day together.
Interesting. Janet?
Well, Ilya speaks about not really knowing who is owning your building or buying your building, and that Adelaide would sometimes have to keep buyers' names under wraps. And that was my portion of the series, Brian. I actually talked about how it can be difficult to know who owns your building, mm-hmm. who just bought your building, and who's selling your building. And this is a construct of the law where companies sometimes register as limited liability corporations or companies, but they don't actually link back to the true beneficial owner of your property. I did some searching into how that can be difficult for tenants and city officials if they don't know the actual owner of a property, and how it can be hard to link one building owner to all of the owner's portfolio.
What's an example of that? Tell us somebody's story.
Well, I ran into some tenants in Crown Heights who had numerous people over the summer knocking on their doors saying to them, I'm the new owner of your building and your rent check should be sent to me. And they had, within the course of 2 weeks, three different people come to their building and tell them where to send the rent, but they couldn't verify this externally. They went to some places and tried to find out if this person was associated with the company they were told purchased their building. It was called Union Ventures, and they couldn't link these individual people to Union Ventures, nor could they confirm that Union Ventures was located at the address where they were told to send their rent check. That can be problematic. Also, I went to see them this winter, and their heat wasn't working. They called people to try to find out who to call. You know, like they called the super, but the super didn't link back to the owner. So where do they go to complain when there's a problem in their building? If they wanted to sue, say a tenant was evicted from a building, or you know, eviction proceedings are started against you and you want to sue the property owner, it takes attorneys quite some time to figure out exactly who that property owner is so that you even know who to sue.
And by the way, this lack of clarity is precisely what makes New York attractive to a lot of overseas investors. They don't want their fingerprints on their investments.
WNYC's Ilya Marritz and Janet Babin with us on their series, Who's Buying New York? Listeners, tell us your story that seems to relate to this. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or anything on the new real estate boom now taking place in the city and construction boom. Stuart in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Brian. Yes, I live on the borderline of Carroll Gardens and Cobble Hill, in a very, you know, desirable neighborhood. But in the last couple of years, we went from $1 million to maybe close to $3 million houses. Now we have $4-6 million-plus houses being built. And what's interesting about it is they're not just buying the houses to renovate them. They're basically buying the lots, demolishing 100-year-old brownstones, and creating bigger houses, which then they're going to, I guess, sell, or they're big apartments, so they have setbacks, so they meet city requirements. But
are they building taller? As Ilya was indicating before, the price of square foot of real estate per square foot driving buildings taller in your neighborhood than you've seen them before.
Yes, they're creeping up now. They all have setbacks so that the upper floors are not at street side. They're back, mm-hmm. but they have a lot of room to do that, and it just balloons out everybody's. Well, it's great for property values, but then our taxes go up, and I think it brings in more professional apartment dwellers than people who want to have one, two, or three family homes. Ours is a three-family brownstone, and I plan to keep it that way. But it seems like my neighbors are more interested in a quick profit. And because we're not landmarked, there's very little control about the style of housing here. So the sense of the traditional brownstone look is being threatened right now. So
that's a story. So you said you're on the border between Carroll Gardens and what?
And Cobble Hill.
Thank you very much, Stuart. Ilya, this sounds like it implies a zoning question for the city.
Yeah, I'm actually a little surprised to hear that. I know that neighborhood pretty well, and I also know that I think about 8 years ago when a large building was built in Carroll Gardens, there was a big outcry and there was a rezoning. to actually try to keep buildings within certain limits. That said, they're, you know, yes, this this is happening all over the city, and it may be that they're allowed to go a little higher than they had been.
I wonder if either of you have reported on the de Blasio administration's feeling about this. We know that part of his push for more affordable housing in the city is for more density, and that means more taller buildings and more neighborhoods that may not be used to buildings that tall, just so more apartments can be built, which by the law of supply and demand is supposed to make them more reasonable, in addition to the requirements for affordable housing and new construction that that they want to place on new construct on new buildings. So is there a de Blasio hook in this story, Janet?
Well, I think, Brian, that the administration has made it clear that density is a key part of them reaching their affordable housing goals to build 80,000 units and preserve 120. So they are looking to use up every inch of possible density. That said, another what the caller talks about is something we found, too, because what you have are these zoning, like if a building is built as of right, you have these zoning lot mergers that happen where developers are able to assemble adjacent air rights or development lots from various buildings. And before you know it, a building is going up across the street from you that's blocking your view or cutting out your sunshine or your light. City Councilwoman Helen Rosenthal on the Upper West Side told us this story about how when she was on the community board, the whole community board was blindsided, not even knowing that this building, the Ariel, was going up on the Upper West Side. So when you have a situation where even community board members are unclear that development rights are being amassed, I think what we're seeing in the city is a lack of transparency around these development rights that allow people to build as of right, but to assemble more air rights that allows developers to build higher.
And there seems to be a contradiction here that on the one hand, more density is supposed to mean more affordable housing, but at the heart of your story is prices going sky high. So do those two things coexist? I don't know if you've reported on this in particular, but, you know, Ilya, it does sound like you suggest that prices are rising in your story today as a result of at least the way that this building boom is taking place.
For me, it's an unanswered question. I'd be curious to know what Janet thinks, but it certainly doesn't seem like the laws of supply and demand as described in an economics textbook, like in their purest form, it doesn't seem like those apply in New York.
Well, the prices are escalating, as Ilya has reported on, and we're seeing clearly. But we are seeing, especially in desirable neighborhoods, so-called opportunity neighborhoods like in Manhattan and key areas in Brooklyn and Queens, that the only affordable housing we're getting is from the 80-20 plans, where the inclusionary housing program is forcing developers or allowing developers to take advantage of tax benefits and tax abatements if they build at least 20% and perhaps more under the de Blasio administration, up to 30% affordable. And that's how we're getting affordable housing for the most part in key desirable areas. 100% affordable housing is being built, Brian, but that's usually in places like East New York and in the Bronx and in Upper Manhattan. We're continuing to see 100% affordable, but even the, quote, 100% affordable buildings, I'm hearing from housing advocates that these properties are now at risk, too, of being bought and sold for way too much money. And that's another way that this lack of transparency could hurt the city. Because say you have a giant developer or someone buying up multifamily properties that can't really afford it, right? Say they're over-leveraging these buildings. They're paying too much for the buildings, and they don't have the money through the rents to maintain those buildings. That could put more affordable housing at risk.
Terry in Wanacue, you're on WNYC. Hi, Terry.
Yes, good morning. I just want to make a comment regarding the New Jersey real estate market, where small apartment complex owners, we have a property in Jersey City, which is in Journal Square, which is very convenient to the PATH train going to downtown Manhattan, and they're experiencing a tremendous building boom as well. Just around the corner from where our small building is, it's a 14-family building, and it's surrounded now by new apartment complexes being built. Older properties are being torn down to build new ones, and this is in Jersey City that I'm aware of. The same is true of Union City, We have a small building there, 25 families. Right near our building is a new development called the Thread, and they're just starting. Well, they've been building it for quite a number of years, and now the Record has featured an article about that particular property in Union City.
Terry, is this good, bad, or mixed for the community, in your opinion?
It's good. It is good. And it gives an opportunity for small landlords like ourselves to provide affordable apartments. We have no problem renting our apartments. It's older buildings. We're very good landlords. We're guided by the rent control guidelines, which are very severe and give very little profitability to the landlords because of government restrictions. So that part isn't very good. But as far as renting apartments for small landlords like ours, like we are, we rent our apartments very quickly. We have no problem. We don't have to advertise it. We just put a sign on the property, which makes it possible for families who are at the low-income end and provides housing for them.
Terry, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. Ben in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how you doing? Actually, the last caller, that's one of the reasons I called. We've been renting in Carroll Gardens area for 10 years. And we're looking to buy something out in Bed-Stuy, hopefully, or Bushwick. And one of my chief concerns is the loss of landlords like your past caller. In other words, even if we went out there to rent, so many of these big corporations are building large condo buildings or in co-ops or renting apartments, and there's no transparency. Who am I really paying the money to? And even more than that, if there's a problem, even if there's a super on site, at the end of the day, who's really responsible? I don't see transparency. Whereas, like, the last 10 years, we're renting from, you know, a lady who lives down the block or a guy who lives down the block, or maybe they moved to Long Island, and you can track them down. And I think there's more. Everybody treats everybody better in that kind of situation.
Janet, you look like you've heard this before.
I have, Brian. We are seeing this lack of transparency, especially as this building boom or the price boom continues here in New York City. So cities and states and New York City does collect data on buildings. However, the official owner of the property can be shielded because the name that is on the registration isn't necessarily the true owner. And even though the city does require property owners to register with the city, only 23%, according to a study from the Furman Center at NYU, only 23% of those property owners required to register with the city have done so. So that's a problem.
And you reported on what you call shell LLCs. Is that related?
That's correct. So in other words, when you file, as you're required to do, you're required to file with the city and with the state. It is a responsible way to own rental property. You create a limited liability company, but in many cases, that company is created for the sole purpose of just owning that one building. So the city doesn't know the true owner behind the name of that LLC, and you can name it anything. You could name it the name of your bird, the name of your dog, anything you want, and that's okay. And it's legal, and that's the way to do it, so the property owners don't get sued. So you limit your liability to this one building. However, this lack of transparency can really hurt the city because they can't see a building owner's portfolio of buildings. And in housing court, judges say there's eviction proceedings. The judge will only consider that one property, not the portfolio of properties, when considering whether to evict a tenant for a landlord.
Fido LLC. Tweety Bird, Inc. Ilya, before you go, how much of this has to do with foreign ownership? I mean, so many of these kinds of complaints could have been leveled in the past against any corporate ownership of apartments as opposed to a more personal landlord-tenant relationship. Is buying a nice apartment here in the city becoming the new Swiss bank account for people from Russia and China, if those are the right countries to mention?
Yeah, well, that's, I think, how New York Magazine called it last year. And it's a hotly debated question. Some people think that international capital is absolutely what is driving this and making this happen. Others say, yeah, it's playing a role, but it's a little bit exaggerated. It's easy to sort of, you know, demonize, you know, rubles
foreigners
and yen,
yeah,
coming here from,
right,
abroad. In a story that I have coming up a little later this week, we're going to take a look at the first all-Chinese development in the United States, the first major Chinese development without a joint venture partner. And I'll tell you, from what I saw there, foreign buyers do play a big role. They're selling 20 to 30% of the apartments that they're selling for this condo that is being built in Williamsburg. 20 to 30% are being sold to Chinese who live in China. I talked with one of their buyers. He has no plans to live in the States. He did his homework. He figured out what kind of rent he can collect on a one bedroom, and he signed papers to buy a one bedroom. Mm. So stay tuned. We're going to hear this story a little later this week.
Well, what would you rather have your money in, the ruble or a building in Williamsburg?
Well, I know, the foreign buyers have incredible interest, and they're also coming up with new constructs in my reporting, Brian, new ways to invest in New York City. To create sort of, some sort of a REIT or real estate investment, a new construct that allows foreign buyers to become more involved in New York City's real estate market because it is so hot when compared especially to the rest of the world.
Securitization of real estate investment? Like we used to have securitization of, real estate investment before
yes.
the financial crisis?
There is some deja vu here.
Yes.
Well, we will leave it there for today. WNYC's Janet Babin and Ilya Meretz reporting on the current real estate boom in the city and continuing their series, Who's Buying New York? Thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Anya Kamenetz on her new book about the standardized test. Is the life cycle of the standardized test as juggernaut in American education finally starting to wane? We'll see if we can get the answer.